I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another one of our Saturday live streams. Today, we're doing a two-part live stream. The first part is going to be on the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, and our guest is Sam Dixon. The second hour will be about the recent American Renaissance Conference, and we're going to have several guests, including Gadius Maximus and Carl Thorburn. But first, I would like to welcome Sam Dixon to the show. Sam, are you there?
I am. Hello. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here. But before we go forward, I have to clear something up. You haven't crossed state lines to be with us, have you, Sam?
No.
Okay, good. Good. Well, I'm glad to get that out of the way. One of the things that I found so amusing about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial is that the left have suddenly rediscovered borders and jails. In fact, they were constantly, breathlessly whispering that Kyle Rittenhouse crossed state lines with his gun. And of course, they should lock him up and throw away the key so he can be abused in jail and things like that. So it's very, very interesting. The left has rediscovered borders and jails temporarily. All that will soon be forgotten. But there's a great deal of wailing and gnashing of teeth out there about this verdict from our enemies. I think it's profoundly satisfying. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on this trial. So have you followed this?
I've followed it fairly carefully. I've not listened in online or watched it on court TV. I have watched episodes of it. And I'm familiar with the background of it. I think I have command of the facts of the matter, the real facts, not the media narrative, which is extremely misleading, as it is in the Arbery trial, which the jury begins deliberations on this Monday.
So the basic issue here, as far as I can see, is the legality of self-defense in America. This kid should not have been put on trial to begin with, based on what I know about the case. Do you think that's true? Do you think that there was any case at all for actually trying him for murder?
Well, if you really stretch it and push the envelope, you could claim that he created the situation. If you create a situation, you can't claim self-defense in it. And if you really strain and struggle and stretch the elastic as far as it could go, you could possibly come up with a pretense of prosecuting him. As I mentioned, the Arbery trial in Brunswick, Georgia, a second ago. In that case, I don't think you can stretch it far enough to justify an indictment. But you could. The thing is, it would, as we all know, everybody listening to this knows that if the racial situation and the ideological situations were reversed, the person who killed, awakened white people, some white activists, would never be prosecuted. It would never happen. So the whole thing is illegitimate in that sense. One thing that went awry for them was that, you know, that they got a rarity, a judge that actually gave a fair trial. And the system is enraged about this, the system and its dupes. They're just furious and feel that the judge was biased. The judge was not biased. The behavior of the prosecutor was outrageous. And in fact, there should be bar complaints seeking the prosecutor's disbarment. He did things that I think most ordinary lay citizens know are not proper. He did things that every lawyer knows are improper. He could not possibly have innocently done these things. Take, for example, his efforts to bring out to the jury the fact that Rittenhouse did not talk to the police, that he remained silent. You know, this is first-year law stuff. And I said, I think probably 80% of your listeners are smart enough to know that a citizen has a right to remain silent and that a prosecutor is absolutely prevented from introducing into evidence in front of the jury the fact that he exercised that right. Because in that way, the prosecutor would be biasing the jury based upon a citizen exercising his rights under the Bill of Rights. But this prosecutor tried that. I think he did it more than once. It's completely understandable that the judge was furious and told him, you know, he said that this had come up in pretrial things, and he had emphasized you cannot bring that out. And then the prosecutor defied the judge. He defied the law. He tried to get into evidence. If I did something like that in court, I'm very sure the Georgia Bar Association would disbar me because they want to disbar me. They'd like to disbar lawyers who are troublemakers. But the prosecutor will be probably given a pass, but certainly Rittenhouse or his lawyers should bring a bar complaint against the prosecutor. It's a far worse thing, in my opinion, when a representative of the state commits an ethical offense than a defense attorney, because that involves the state and the government itself in unethical behavior. Not that I believe in the system. I actually have an odd wrinkle in my opinion of this trial that could be misconstrued. It might be upsetting to our listeners. And that is, if you want to look at it in a strictly revolutionary way, it would have been better for the race at large if poor little Kyle Rittenhouse had been wrongfully convicted. Naturally, my emotional sympathies are 100% engaged with him, and I was as happy as any of your listeners to hear that he'd been acquitted. But what is desperately needed in our country and throughout the European world is a loss of faith in the system. As you and I have discussed many times, either the system has to go or our race goes. Where there is no reform, there is no remedy in the system. And the unfortunate side of the very just and appealing acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse is that tens of millions of normies and moderate conservatives will have their faith in the system restored. You know, hey, look, the system worked. And it did for once. They got maybe the one judge out of four who's a straight shooter. Many of the judges for whom I have defended dissidents would have fixed the thing in many, many ways. And that would have been applauded by the media, as they're applauding Judge Moon in Charlottesville with some remarkably unjust, in my opinion, orders and decisions there.
Let's talk a bit about Charlottesville a little later. Before we go much further, there are a lot of things to talk about here. I want to talk about the necessity of losing faith in the system. I think that's an important thing. Before we go there, though, let's talk about why this prosecutor flagrantly violated due process in trying to construe guilt from exercising one's right to remain silent. Why do you think he did that? Do you think perhaps that he believed his case was so hopeless that he was trying to get a mistrial so they could get another crack at it?
I wouldn't put it past him. He could, or he could have been trusting that because he represents the system side, that the judge would bend the rules in every possible way to help him, which judges generally do. I think the majority of judges are simply system people, and they don't follow the rules. When it's a system, a matter that's important to the system, they bend the rules. So I think he probably wasn't expecting the rules to be enforced. Also, he has the reassurance that the Bar Association is not going to punish him. They would punish Rittenhouse's defense lawyer. They're not going to punish him. And of course, it's not a losing case for the prosecution and entirely. He did lose the case, but he has shown his bona fides that he is, in fact, a system toady. And that's very important to his career. He'll keep his job. He may be appointed judge. He may be elevated to be an appellate judge. So if he's looking out for number one, he still put points on the board. And he may have just counted that the jury would do what the system wanted. I was overjoyed, as you were and everybody else emotionally, with the result of the trial. But this not only was an unusual judge, it was an unusual jury. And the system narrative in the media has been that the jury was not representative, they lacked diversity. In the case of Chauvin up in Minneapolis, the system reported with glee and approval the statement of the judge that it was perhaps the most diverse jury in the history of Minnesota. And of course, had Kyle Rittenhouse had a diverse jury, he would probably be in jail right now.
Yeah, that's very
an area where you would get a white jury. When you get non-whites on the jury, you can just pretty much write them off. With very rare exceptions, they're going to vote for their race, and they're not They're not like white people in England or Sweden or in America or whatever. They are not troubled with these feelings of fair play and chivalry. They're hard. We're hardwired to have that. They are hardwired not to have that.
Yeah. In this case, though, the attempt to construe it as racial primarily would be somewhat strained for the simple fact that all of the parties here, both Rittenhouse and the three people he shot, are at least by the census reckoning white. And yeah, of course, these three thugs, two of them Jews, one of them a pedophile, all of them with criminal records, were out there under the guise of, you know, caring about Black lives. That's why they were setting dumpsters afire and hurling bricks and other deadly things at policemen and so forth. But in the end, it was just a bunch of white people killing one another in the minds of a lot of Blacks. I think that might be one of the reasons why, that and the fact that it's cold, that there wasn't a lot of Black rioting over this, although it was certainly threatened as an attempt to tamper with the jury.
Yeah, I think that it would have been a stretch, but I think Blacks are very, they're not as inferior. A lot of whites are very cocky about Blacks. Blacks in some way are superior to whites. They're more loyal. They think very in very simple terms. They don't get misled by so-called principles or ideologies or political philosophies. And I think most Blacks would pick up on it, that it would be a good thing for the Black community if Kyle Rittenhouse were put in jail and was Rufus's girlfriend for the next 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, the blue and white check marks on Twitter, the hateful, frothing liberals who monopolize social media. Literally, they monopolize it now. These people were out for blood. Some of them were explicitly talking about the fact that two of the victims were Jews. And that's far more important than Black lives to the Twitter mob. And beyond that, they were very, very concerned because BLM got a free pass last year. Basically, we had a president who was up for re-election and was terrified of losing Black votes, and a cowardly Republican Party all standing around shuffling uneasily, hands in their pockets, wishing that this would all go away so none of them had to do anything brave. And then we had, in short, the best lacked all conviction. And then the left were frothing, raving maniacs urging the mobs on because the worst are full of passionate intensity. And the net result was that America went for months with, you know, chaos. You know, untold numbers of people were killed, injured, their livelihoods were destroyed, public monuments were destroyed, cities were befouled, and there was no justice anywhere in America. Now, all this was taking place with the sufferance of the government, who kept their guns holstered, and also the 80 million or so people who voted for Donald Trump, who probably own, I don't know, 250 million of the firearms in the United States. They mostly kept their guns holstered too. And then we have this incident in Kenosha where the mob is looting and burning. You get these psychopaths, this Jewish pedophile, these other people, rapists. Some of the Gage Grosskreutz beat up his grandmother, apparently. Multiple DUIs, weapons charges. These people are scum. And these are the people who felt liberated to trash the town. And this kid who's 17 years old fought back. And I think they saw in Kyle Rittenhouse the America that they're afraid of waking up.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, yeah. And so they had to make an example of him, just I think in the same way that they want to make an example out of the McMichaels in Georgia. These people look like rednecks from Central Casting. They were looking out for their neighborhood. They were noticing things. They were armed with guns. And they have to be made an example of because we cannot have white people fighting back. White people have to peaceably be shuffled off the stage and off to extinction, basically. That's the program of the establishment.
Now, I remember years ago, Alan Dershowitz wrote a column, the horrible Jewish lawyer at Harvard. And in his column, he said that he wouldn't quite define who they and them were, but it was quite clear he meant ordinary white Christian Americans who don't go with the Kennedys and the New Frontier and that kind of thing, and, the Great Society. He said they must never be allowed to win a victory. They must always suffer defeats. And that, I think, is along the line of what you're saying, that he had to be made an example of. If you defend law and order from savages that are burning a city down, then you will be punished. Anyone that feels that degree of community loyalty, that lack of individualism, must be punished. And Rittenhouse, he seems like a fairly immature guy because he's only 17 or was when he went there. But he apparently has what a normal, healthy person and what all Blacks and Jews have, which is a commitment to his community. He was not looking out for number one, to quote the Jewish libertarian Robert Ringer in his disgusting book, Looking Out for Number One. He was selfless. He took action on behalf of the community as a whole. And they don't want whites doing that. They want whites to be individualized and to look out for number one and never offer any resistance to the organized antagonists in these different racial and national groupings that are assaulting our civilization and trying to take our turf.
Absolutely. It was an error, in a way, for Kyle Rittenhouse to believe that this is his system, that this is his government. But it's certainly not an error for him to believe that it's right to be willing to sacrifice oneself for a higher good. He just didn't realize that the system that he was going to take some risks for is in the hands of his enemies, and that the system that he was trying to protect was actually the system that was enabling the chaos that was destroying Kenosha and very nearly destroyed him.
I don't know if he really thought he was defending the system. I think he was more likely just outraged at what you were talking about, which was that these violent leftists and Jews and Blacks were allowed to take to the streets and commit crimes with impunity, including rather shocking scenes. I saw one on Tucker Carlson. Of them assaulting a store owner. And this was not a matter of lighting some fires, like National Public Radio said. There were eight or nine of them beating the holy hell out of this guy. He was down on the ground, appeared to be unconscious, and they were just kicking and kicking and kicking like hornets after something. I think he acted because the system was not acting. And I think he certainly must have a grasp now. This system is not his system.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have to depart into obscurantism, which you often chide me for, but I can't help myself. Until 1828, police departments were unknown in English-speaking, Anglo-Saxon countries. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, the first police department created in England was in 1828 when Peel was the prime minister. That's why there's a slang term in England for cops. They're called peelers. And he had a proposal in the House of Commons to create a police department, police departments in municipal areas. This did not pass without a lot of opposition. When it came to the House of Lords, the lords, the aristocrats, expressed astonishment. They said, are we so lacking in red-blooded Englishmen that they have to have higher bodyguards to protect them? Because up until then, the understanding was that the people enforced the law. This was later codified in the United States in laws allowing what they call citizens' arrests. You probably have heard of those, which comes into play in the Brunswick case. Our wretched Republican governor, Brian Kemp, went along with the Democrats in repealing our citizens' arrest law after the incident that led to the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick. And the media said that the law had been passed by a white racist segregationist legislature. Well, no, it just codified common law. There are states all over America that have almost no blacks in them who have citizens' arrest. But Brian Kemp is so stupid and so sociopathic that he wouldn't care if he were intelligent enough to know any of these things. So we actually repealed the citizens' arrest law because of Arbery and because of a bunch of people demonstrating in the streets and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution having its panties in a row. And you wonder where this is going to lead. If somebody breaks into your house and rapes your wife, and you come upon the scene and you've got a gun and you pull a gun out and you're holding a gun on the rapist, is it illegal for you to hold the rapist to do a citizen's arrest until the police come? Does Brian Kemp and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, are we to say, well, all right, you're through raping my wife now and I've stopped it with the gun. You can run away now. If you're lucky, the police won't get here in time to arrest you. I can't restrain you because that'd be racist. That'd be white racism and white supremacy for me to.
This seems like it's creating a moral hazard, and the moral hazard would be that you can't hold them at gunpoint. You might as well just shoot them dead and make up a plausible story about it afterwards. That's crazy.
You know where that would go. It would go where the McMichaels find themselves now in Brunswick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing. Taking away the citizen's arrest law is basically penalizing self-defense and this is a system, penalizing self-defense and liberating crime, black crime. I've said it many times.
Enabling criminals to flee the scene of the crime with impunity.
Absolutely. You know, I've said it many times, if you want to destroy civilization, you just make it illegal to arrest black people or illegal to resist their crimes, and they'll take care of it all. They'll suddenly do the work. They'll be up to that task.
I don't mean to be a cuck because I'm solidly committed, as you know, to the radical evil, according to the media, white supremacist movement notion that European white people have the same right to an ethnostate as Jews do in the Middle East. I have to apologize. I know that's just about the worst thing you could believe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the fact is, when we have our ethnostate, there are criminal white people. And they all, I mean, it's just a principle of society. You should be able to detain a criminal. Yeah, and that was our common law among the long before blacks showed up in our civilization. That's what Anglo-Saxons believe. And all of that now is scrapped, and there's not one word of defense of it in the system media, which just went on with this uninterrupted monologue claiming that the citizens' arrest law was passed by white racists to enable whites to victimize blacks. It's just complete fantasy.
Even if it were true, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a citizen's arrest law. It's just poisoning the well. It's an ad hominem fallacy to say that, oh, bad people did this, so it must go away. Even if they were horrible people, I don't grant, there's still good reason why you want people to feel entitled to resist evil.
Now on a much lower scale than a murder or a rape or something like that, you know, citizens are going to be able to, perpetrators are going to be able to put on a mask and run in the store and grab the TV and run out the store.
Yeah.
And if there's a security guard there, without arrest power, and he tries to stop him, like you've interfered with his rights.
There's a right to steal.
And he resists, and you hurt him. People like Brian Kemp and our wretched Attorney General Chris Carr are going to indict you so they can have a photo op in Atlanta in front of an admiring news media.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to entropy. Folks, if you would like to help out Countercurrents this year, we are doing a fundraiser. The only way that you can help us and use one of those wretched pieces of plastic, the credit card, one of those indispensable things that makes civilization possible these days. The only way you can do it is to go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. We've been completely deplatformed from the global credit card processing industry. We've been blacklisted, which I treat as a compliment, frankly. We're scaring the merchants at the very top of the banking hierarchy and all their friends, and that's a compliment, I think. But you can use your credit card to send money to us through Entropy Stream. That's across the bottom of the screen. Just go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, hit the green button. You can send a question, comment, and donation our way, and we will be very grateful. We will thank you, and we will talk about them in the course of the stream. So if you'd like to ask me and Sam questions about this trial, the Arbery trial, the Rittenhouse trial, the Arbery trial, or the trial that just went to the jury in Charlottesville, please do that. You can also send your DLive tokens, your diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, etc., of course, your questions and comments, and we will get to those as well, and we will try and answer them as best we can. So I would like to thank, okay, we've got several questions here. Gadius Maximus, who's going to join us in the second hour, writes in with $40. Thank you very much. It's the season for giving, folks. Remember, every time you donate to Countercurrents, a Rosenbaum gets its horns. That's very good. I like that. Nationalist Willie writes in with $50, very generous. Jerry Nadler is calling upon the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland's Department of Justice, to investigate after the verdict to see if they can bring some kind of federal charges against poor Kyle Rittenhouse. What are your thoughts on that, Sam?
Well, you know, we have an incredible attorney general who is basically waging war on the civil rights of American citizens. You know, they use the FBI now openly as a weapon of intimidation on Americans. They're using it now even on people that go and appear before school boards to complain about the curriculum in the public schools. That these people are supposed terrorists and are supposedly threatening people. I think I read that Garland was asked in Congress what threats school boards had received, and he couldn't name any. He said that he had just taken it off of a statement issued out by some kind of teachers, left-wing teachers organization, complaining, claiming that there were all these threats. You know, here again, that you can turn the lemons into lemonade. One of the great things that's going on is that large numbers of the core demographics in America, the original Anglo-Saxon founding stock and related nationalities from places like Italy and Poland and Germany and Ireland, they're coming to see the FBI as what it is, the equivalent of our own native-born political police who are lawbreakers and who exist to violate our rights on behalf of a corrupt system. So it's good in a way to have Garland up there throwing the FBI around and misusing government power to do things like indict Kyle Rittenhouse again. I don't know how they, even with as horrible as the system is, as totally corrupt and dishonest as it is, and with people like Biden and Garland running it, it's hard to imagine what kind of a charge they could bring against Rittenhouse. You know, it's not really a federal crime. I guess they probably have some crime about going across state lines. I think there's one about crossing state lines to cause riots that Nixon threw in as a payoff to conservatives to get some sort of pro-left law passed in the 60s. It's never been used until recently when it was used against the Proud Boys.
It'll never be used against Antifa, though.
No, of course not.
It's very interesting.
The FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the United States Justice Department will never do that. And every listener needs to understand that and needs to tell his friends, his spouse, his children, his grandchildren that this is the case. So they will understand what we're dealing with when you deal with the FBI and the Justice Department.
Yeah, it's very interesting. One of the victims, the one who survived, Gage Grosskreutz, had a number of weapons violations, including the night of the riot. He was not licensed to carry a concealed weapon. Kyle Rittenhouse was not violating any laws by carrying that rifle, but Gage Grosskreutz was violating the law by carrying his pistol. Grosskreutz was never charged with anything. Kyle Rittenhouse was charged with murder and three other counts before any kind of real investigation could have taken place, before they had drone surveillance footage gathered, etc. It was all transparently political. And we have to just constantly harp on this fact that it's transparently political and it's anti-white. It's anti, basically, in this case, I mean, it's actually an anti-Semite's dream, this particular case, because the blacks were just props. What you had here was Antifa, who are largely, by census criteria, at least white people. And he shoots three Antifa. Two of the three are Jewish. All three of them have criminal records. One of them was a pedophile who raped five little boys. Another, Huber, who's also dead, had some kind of sexual assault charges. Grosskreutz beat up his grandmother. These people are absolute scum. So it's really, in this case, a battle between normal people and absolute pathological scum, you know, the underclass, basically, the pampered criminal underclass of America, not just blacks, but also Antifa. And it's very, very clarifying, this battle, and to see that the system has systematically, the only thing systematic about the system is its anti-whiteness and anti-normal whiteness. I guess that's really what's being highlighted here. They are going against normal, decent white people who take responsibility for their communities and fight back when they're attacked by sociopaths and savages and child molesters.
Somebody, in the case of Rittenhouse, somebody who behaved the way English-speaking males behaved all over the world until 1828. I was surprised. I spoke with a person whom I have great respect in our cause. I will not name, but he would be known to you. And he casually remarked that, well, Rittenhouse was a fool. He had no business going there. You know, Rittenhouse was a fool in terms of his going to jail and his own personal interests. But no, he was an idealist. He was somebody who cared about this community at large. He went and protected the businesses of other people from these mobs that the corrupt system was allowing to you know, burn and loot and beat and so on. So you know, I think Rittenhouse is really a noble guy. I'm glad he had a white jury. If he'd had the kind of jury that they had in Minneapolis, he'd be going to jail.
Right. So ABC writes in with $10. Thank you. Without video footage, Kyle Rittenhouse would have been given a long, hard time. No doubt about that. Maybe alt-right rallies should be extensively covered by video cameras, including body cams worn especially by people in charge of security, drone footage not excluded, all uploaded in real time. I would agree with that. Why not add our own drones to the whizzing cacophony that's spying on us all the time, right? At least we would have...
Absolutely. I recommended to clients of mine all the way back in the late 80s that they get video cameras and videotape things because the Georgia Bureau of Investigation was committing horrific violations of the law and harassing dissident groups. And that really, I think the police and the system are going to have to do something about videos. There's so much video surveillance now that it's going to make the task of people like these system operatives and people like Morris Dees of railroading people, it's going to make it a lot harder for them. You know, because if you're just walking past a store, you know, in Atlanta at 7 p.m. and you get caught on the video, it makes it hard for them to claim that somebody saw you somewhere else at 7 p.m. This will be very helpful. And all your listeners in America should keep this in mind, that if you're accused of a crime and you weren't there, you must go immediately to try to find out as quickly as you can whether you were in front of any video camera surveillance system somewhere else to establish your alibi, because these images that they take are routinely erased after a certain number of days. And I've known normie cases in criminal cases. There was one in Atlanta where a guy who was being set up and framed by the cops on a drug violation was able to his lawyer was quick and smart and got to the service station where the alleged action took place and got the videotape surveillance. And the district attorney was forced to drop the charges at the preliminary hearing because it showed the cops planting the so-called evidence.
Amazing. Of course, one of the things that has been an enormous boon to law enforcement is this strange behavior of Black people live streaming themselves committing crimes and putting them on social media as if there will be no consequences whatsoever.
Well, as has often been said, the wicked are not always wise.
Yes, and, yeah.
And, you know, and one of the little interesting aspects of what's going on in Brunswick with the McMichaels trial is the system media repeats every time they mention it that in front of a jury with only one African American, this is the mantra that is always repeated. And of course, this is an area of Georgia where African Americans probably make up 35 or 40% of the population, so they are underrepresented, just as they are overrepresented in the jury in Charlottesville for some reason or another. But there the reason for the underrepresentation in the McMichaels jury is because the Blacks filled out the jury questionnaires that were mailed out to prospective jurors, and they wrote things down like, yeah, I'm going to get those white people, and things like that. So many of them had to be eliminated for cause, whereas people like the victims, the two guys that were killed and three that were shot in Charlottesville, that kind of person would know to lie and claim they could be fair and get on the jury and fix the result. That kind of person is much wiser and smarter. But the Blacks just let it all hang out. And that's why there's only one on that jury.
That's very, very interesting. Exocet has written in with $10. Thank you very much for your donation. I'm just looking here. Horatio Nelson has written in with $20. And he wants to thank us for what we did last week when we covered the BioShock video games. Thanks for covering BioShock last week. I think that the importance of video games in shaping the culture is underestimated. In 2020, the global video game industry had more revenue than the global movie industry and U.S. sports combined. Wow. Gamers tend to be young men, so it is propagandizing a group we should be reaching out to. I totally agree, and I also feel totally inadequate to deal with that because I've never played one of these video games. I think when I was a kid, I watched somebody play Pac-Man for a few minutes, and then I think I went and sat down and read a book or something. So I am completely unqualified to comment on it, but fortunately, younger and hipper people like American Krogan, whom we had on last week, are doing amazing work on this. So the BioShock discussion is up at Countercurrents now if you want to look into that. So folks, any other questions or comments? Let's just check here. Okay, over at Entropy, we have received from Bartleby One Ice Cream, thank you, and Ganser Prenadier has donated a Ninjagini. He has a question. Mr. Dixon, any chance you'll ever write the book on financial advice for white nationalists?
I wish. I'm very, you know, people give me too much credit. The Antifa give me too much credit. I don't know why they're so interested in me, because I really have done, compared to you and people like Jared Taylor and Frody and people like that, I've done almost nothing. I've just made a few talks. But really, I'm very much chagrined and embarrassed that I haven't done more. I would like to write that book, as well as several other books. And I think I can give people, I have managed to keep my head above water in the face of really strong headwinds against my legal practice and against me financially. And I can give white people, I think a lot, or really anybody that read the book, but I'd like to write it specifically for our people, a lot of advice, very practical advice on how to survive financially. I gave a talk on this a few weeks ago to an organization that will go unnamed on how people can make themselves financially independent. But I hope this will happen. I'm trying to divest myself of my investments. I'm trying to clear out, as you know, this colossal backlog of real estate. And that's eating my time. And I'm running out of time. I'm almost 75, and I'm realistic to know that the novel is in its closing chapters. You know, the denouement is coming, and I don't want to die and leave these projects unfinished.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In the end, you know, how to put it, you know, you lose everything in the end anyway, you know, and what we accomplish in the world is ultimately by spending ourselves rather than saving ourselves. And you have to always ask yourself, okay, what are you saving yourself for? Because ultimately it's got to be spent. And I do hope that you can clear some time. Yeah. And get a secretary, get a secretary to take down this stuff. And that's one way of doing it. I have been trying to persuade, oh goodness, I'm blanking out his name now. This is terrible. Martin Webster. I've been trying to persuade Martin Webster to write an autobiography because he has so many fascinating stories.
He certainly should.
And you know, I put out one of my first book projects was back in 2006. I put out And Time Rolls On, which is the a 200-page book. It's a transcription of interviews that Savitri Devi gave in 1978. And it basically works as an autobiography and as a compendium of her ideas. And it's a great introduction to her ideas. And so one way of doing this might be simply to get somebody to record your thoughts about various things and transcribe them. Just get them
transcribed. That would be easily done, but it would also be pretty sloppy. Well, one project, people, I know that you're trying to set up things to pursue projects, and there are other people doing it, but we are very bad about documenting our own movement. You know, the left, for all that they claim they hate the past and have no care for the past, they are very attentive to documenting their movement. I saw this in Mountain College in the 1960s. The New Left had all these articles about communist labor organizing in the South in the 1930s and things that they were very interested in preserving and documenting the roots of their cause. Almost nothing is being done about this. I'm trying to get a fairly famous person here in Atlanta interviewed. I tried to do it at the American Renaissance Conference, but he didn't have time. A very important person with quite a story to tell, not very important, but certainly a story to tell, committed suicide about 3 weeks ago in North Carolina, and that story is now unobtainable. But we really should have interviews with people who have played roles or witnessed things. I know all kinds of people that I knew when I was in my teens and 20s who saw things in the civil rights movement that are now airbrushed out of history, who saw the behavior of the civil rights demonstrators and know facts about the real history of the civil rights movement that will be gone now. They'll be gone forever.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a very important project, and that could really be almost a full-time project for somebody just to be both a archivist and oral historian of our cause. I've done a lot over the last 20 odd years now trying to preserve information about Savitri Devi. And I saved a lot of stuff that if I hadn't gotten involved, it probably would be lost now to history.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of stuff was lost to history because I started too late, and it still eats at me when I learn about things like, you know, 35 years of correspondence that were destroyed by somebody's executor because she found the ideas in them offensive. That kind of nonsense. That is just tragic, and we need to preserve the history of our cause, most definitely.
And we need to we need to humanize those who have led us. Imagine if we had an interview with Wilmot Robertson about his life. I don't think he would ever consent. I tried to do that. He wouldn't consent. I tried to make one of Revelo P. Oliver in the early stages of video technology. And unfortunately, it turned out so poor. I think Martin O'Toole still has a copy of it. But it's so wretched that it doesn't add much. But at least I was able to talk to him about his life, what caused him to become a thought criminal and things like that. But these are very interesting stories of how people like you and perhaps myself came to be thought criminals. And these things really need to be preserved, a humanized, seamless story of someone's life. Someone should do it for Martin Webster, but even if he doesn't write his memoirs, it'd be a matter of just setting up the video camera and having a good interviewer, somebody that can ask questions like you or some of the other people, Paul Hersey. They could just interview him and you'd have a statement about him. People 50 years, 100 years from now will be able to look at him and hear what he had to say. Imagine if we had something like that for people like Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant, Senator Burton K. Wheeler, and so mm-hmm. on. It'd be fabulous to have things like that.
Yeah, I did do an interview with Martin that's up at Countercurrents. I recorded it in 2015, I believe. And mm-hmm. he said that he's going to have something for me to look at in the spring. So maybe he's going to surprise me with an autobiography. I would love to publish that. He just has so many interesting stories. He knew so many interesting people. And we can learn a lot. We can learn a lot from the past if it's preserved. And all these threads are broken constantly, and all these lives and their memories are lost. It's very interesting. When you think that it's in every generation, there are people who live 100 years. In every generation. that means that there are people alive today that were born 100 years ago. And in their lifetime, at the beginning of their lifetimes, there were people who were 100 years old. And at the beginning of those people's lifetimes, there were people that were 100 years old. Etc., which means that basically in four long lifetimes span the entire history of white people in North America.
Well, as a personal example, I had a great aunt who lived to be 107, and she was sharp, mentally sharp, almost to the day she died, and. Fortunately, when I was a child, my brothers were completely disinterested in what old people had to say, but I was always interested in what old people had to say. And I went to her house on a number of occasions and asked her, what was life like in slavery days? What was life like during the Civil War? What happened in Reconstruction? And she told me stories of what she had seen. And, so people do live long, and they do have stories to tell.
Yeah, it given that, literally four long lifetimes ago, white people first set foot on the North American continent and made a settlement. If people took the time to pass on what they know, we would have a very, very good picture of what it was like in Jamestown 400 years ago.
What you just said brings up a very important point, and that is there are many very bad folkways among white Europeans and especially among Anglo-Saxons. And one of them is this term you hear people say, these words you hear people say all the time, they have to learn it on their own.
Absolutely. That is such rubbish.
No, they don't. You learn your language in a very fascistic manner from your mother. That's why it's called your mother tongue. And a responsible generation does not allow its children and grandchildren to have to go out and make the same mistakes. But people say this with a great sense of righteousness. That, oh, yeah, they need to stand. They'd be rugged individualists and stand there and learn it on their own. We digress from our subject of the trials that are going on. But there's another one, since somebody wrote in about a book of financial advice. That people need to think about, and that is it's their money, isn't it, or whatever about leaving money to the next generation. You know, we can learn a lot from Jews. If you want to know how to grow roses, you learn from your neighbor who's rose has a good rose garden. Jews have been fabulously successful, and we can learn by taking a page from their books. Jews reach across generations. The grandparents help the grandchildren. The parents help the parent. Their parents, and so on. And they don't have to make it on their own. They don't have. It isn't a matter of. It's their money, isn't it? When somebody of inheritances come up, people say very rightly, "Well, it's their money." Well, who wrote that book? Wrote Rue. That statement causes a lot of unhappiness. It creates cognitive dissonance in people who have a legitimate right as a good son or daughter, a good nephew, or someone like yourself who's lived a life of the race. It creates sort of a cognitive dissonance in them that somehow it's bad to entertain the idea that when my mother or father or aunt or uncle or whoever dies, I have a reasonable expectation as a worthy member of their family that I will be the natural object of their affection. It's a terrible idea. And there are all these awful folkways.
Kids' inheritance. That as a bumper sticker.
Oh, what, yeah. Horrible people. The Jews wrote a book that they gave great reviews on. It was reviewed repeatedly in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and things. It's called Die Broke. Anyone listening can go Google it. It's a thing about you don't want to ruin your children's character by leaving them an inheritance. They won't make it on their own. Their character will be ruined. You need to spend it all. And if you do die with anything, it needs to go to something like the National Organization of Women. It needs to go to something that will help people, immigrant relief, I think. But you'll be a bad parent if you actually leave resources to your children.
Yeah, I'm sure whoever wrote that book did not follow that advice with his or her own children.
No, of course.
We have another question. Nationalist Willie has written in with $50. Thank you very much. Do you think Kyle Rittenhouse has a good chance of winning major settlements like Nick Sandman against the fake news for labeling him a white supremacist?
No, I'm very skeptical of that. And I discourage all white activists from ever going to court. It's just very dangerous. You cannot imagine how bad the courts are. Lay people who haven't experienced this, lawyers who haven't experienced this, where it involves movement people, have no idea how bad the courts are. I'll throw out a quick example because we're about out of time. James Edwards, you may recall that the Detroit Free Press, the major newspaper in Detroit, Michigan, stated that James Edwards was a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, you would think that would be filing a defamation suit on something like that would be like shooting a pig in the pen. I mean, it's a no-brainer. He's never been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He's not a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And he and his very brilliant lawyer, Kyle Bristow, who's a magnificent lawyer, talked to me about it. And Kyle was very young. He's still very young and very idealistic. And I told him the suit will go nowhere. And they said, "Oh, it can't be. It's a strong suit." Well, it did go nowhere. The trial judge ruled in favor of the paper against this what the Soviets called a non-person or former person, James Edwards, somebody that is despised by the system. They ruled that, oh, well, you can be a leader of something without being a member, because something you write might influence them. And a leader influences people. So it was okay to call him a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And then they appealed it to the appellate courts away from the self-promoting trial judge. And guess what? The appellate courts not only affirmed it, they put in their decision. There's now a reported decision in American jurisprudence. They stated that, well, and besides the fact that he could have influenced the Klan by being by what he wrote and said, he had Sam Dixon on his program, and Sam Dixon is a member of the Ku Klux Klan. That's now in an actual reported decision. I have never been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, there's no evidence in the case that I was ever a member of the Ku Klux Klan. But this is how the courts work. You stay away from courts. You stay out of court.
Well, Sandman has gone on record saying definitely you should sue them. And God knows how much money he got. He had non-disclosure agreements to hide it. So, you know, Rittenhouse isn't as much of a he isn't actually a white supremacist, and maybe he can. I hope he does.
He's close enough, and the system has something at stake.
Yeah,
Court settlements are a means of the left to enrich its own. And I know we're out of time, but here's a factoid you're probably not aware of, or your audience is not aware of. 2 weeks ago, the Biden administration settled with the nine families of the nine people who were killed by Dylann Roof at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. They settled a suit against the federal government based upon a claim that the federal government should not have, the agency that reviews people about getting handguns should not have approved Dylann Roof. This was a no-brainer. The suit would never have been won by these people. There was no real reason to refuse a gun permit to Dylann Roof. They claim, well, he had had mental illness problems. The type of mental illness he had is not something that bars people from getting the guns. So the whole thing it should have been thrown out on directed verdict, summary judgment. Each family got $10 million from the taxpayers of America, $90 million that could have gone to build fast-track trains, all kinds of schools for gifted children. Every American citizen of every age paid a quarter to those families. And that's the kind of fraud that lay people don't know is going on, but it happens very frequently, these collusive settlements between the system government and system litigants.
Amazing. I did not know that. That is amazing. We have another Ninjagini from Ganser Prenadir. He says, I'd pay $1,000 for the Revelo Oliver tape. Sam, the Revelo Oliver tape might look bad as a video, but if the sound is audible, it can be turned into an audio and released, and it might be extremely useful. So it's definitely worth preserving.
I'll ask the person who was last known to have it, and we'll see if he's got it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to. It's amazing what you can do on your laptop with audio editing programs now. We can make it sound as good as possible and put it online, and it'll be out there forever, bouncing around in the ether.
It's so bad. We didn't have lighting equipment. I mean, I don't know anything about this stuff. You know how I know so little about technology. I know a lot about conjugating German and Latin, Russian and Latin verbs. I don't know much about practical things. But we took it outside in his garden to take the advantage of the sun, and this damn plane kept flying overhead with this roar. I guess with the right kind of equipment, you could probably get the plane noise out of the thing. But anyway, let's give it a try.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely worth a try. Well, we have gone for an hour, and we need to wrap up because I'm going to now shift to another topic, which is last week's AMREN conference. I know you were there, Sam, but we're going to hear from some of the people in the audience about their experiences. But before we go, tell us how people can follow your work, your ideas. Do you have a website out there, or what is your platform?
It's a website that one of my closest friends, Widow, set up. Just did it on her own because she knows how out of touch I am and how I live in the quill pen generation. It's called The Real Sam Dixon. I have to confess, I haven't looked at it in 2 years, but there is something that has some of my work up there. And you can always find my talks on the American Renaissance site. YouTube, I understand, has taken them down. They took a very, I brag on myself, I gave a very good talk two conferences back about the idea of equality and the crimes that this delusion has led to, which are far greater than any crimes committed in the name of racial differences or genetic differences. And it had nothing to do with race, had nothing to do with Jews, didn't touch any of the radioactive issues, but they took it down as hate. But I think AMREN has all of those talks up, and that'd be the best way to get it.
That was a great talk. I was there. I remember that. I think it's excellent. And I think it's probably available on maybe BitChute or Odyssey at the American Renaissance channels that are there, I believe. So yeah, that's definitely worth pursuing. So Sam, thank you so much. And we will definitely have you back very, very soon, because there's going to be a verdict, I'm pretty sure, at the Charlottesville trial. And I'd love to get your thoughts on that once that's done and wrapped.
Yes. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to people. You have helped me do the kind of things that I need to do.
Well, thank you again.
And I'll add one little bit of advice to the in support of your request for support. If you don't support people that are speaking out for us, you answer the question of why isn't somebody doing anything? And I'll end it with an obscure Latin quote, "Bis dat quicito dat." He doubly gives, he gives quickly.